from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. If you've ever read the comments section of websites, looked closely at responses on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or traveled to some of the dark or not so dark corners of the internet, you've probably seen some ugly, hateful language, maybe even threatening and violent. For women in particular, the web can get menacing in a hurry. Anonymous sexual threats, threats of violence, really ugly. So ugly that some are saying it's time to stand up to it with the help of tech companies and or the law. This hour On Point, the ugly reservoir of internet aggression toward women and what to do about it. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Women, have you seen it? Women, men, how do you explain it? Before we get started, a note to our listeners, this hour may contain some graphic language, some difficult topics, may not be appropriate for children. Beware. With me first today from Pasadena, California, is Amanda Hess. She writes about sex, culture, and more for Slate, Wired, The Los Angeles Times, ESPN The Magazine, New York Times, The Village Voice, and more. She wrote in this month's Pacific Standard Magazine an article headlined, Why Women Aren't Welcome on the Internet. There's a link at our website, onpointradio.org. Amanda Hess, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Aren't welcome on the internet seems like a very mild way of headlining the abuse that you're describing in this article. I have to say, I came away feeling, I mean, I see the rough and tumble on the web, but I don't see it through the eyes of a woman. And I came away kind of just staggered at how rough, how rugged, how violent, how abusive it can be. Now, we've got to be careful in this hour because we don't want to just replicate some of the worst of this on the air. But give us a sense what you came up against and how.
So since I first started writing online in 2007, I've received a sort of number of incidents of threatening and harassing messages, ranging from just sort of generalized misogynistic commentary to specific threats against my life. And the most recent time that happened, I was actually on vacation in Palm Springs. I woke up at 5:30 in the morning because my friend had alerted me to an anonymous Twitter account that had been set up for the purposes of threatening me. Someone was saying that they lived in my state, that they were going to come to my house and rape me and cut off my head. They were also saying that I was ugly and fat and all other sort of rude things. And it was unclear what I should do about that because on the one hand, it seemed unlikely that anyone was actually going to cut my head off. It's ludicrous. But on the other hand, the person who had set up this account seemed to be sort of obsessed with me, and they seemed a bit deranged. And so I thought it would be best to alert the authorities.
They were using username on Twitter, I guess, Headless Female Pig, which is about as kind of wacky, menacing as you can get in a way.
Right. And so I guess, you know, that would be me. So I called 911 in Palm Springs. An officer came to my door. And when I told him what happened, he said to me, "What is Twitter?"
That's some place to start when you've got a threat like this on your doorstep. But on the other hand, you know, there's still plenty of people who are not plugged into that whole world, and it certainly doesn't seem very plugged into the world of policing.
That was my experience and the experience of some other women who I talked to. Particularly local police departments are both, you know, ill-equipped to handle these issues. There's not a lot of education in the police force for them. And they're also, you know, much more male than some federal agencies.
But why even go to the police? I'm looking at an article here on Slate by a guy named Jim Pagel. It says, "Death threats on Twitter are meaningless. You should ignore them," is the headline.
Yeah, that is a common attitude among, you know, friends, family members, police officers. And so what my story was sort of trying to do was to really lay out the evidence of why, you know, A, women do not have the luxury of ignoring threats, and B, why it's a, you know, a social issue and potentially an issue of discrimination against women.
I'm looking here. You go on from your own story, and this is not by any means the only instance in which you receive threats like this online. You wrap in the stories of many women. Most of them, I have to say, you know, of some prominence, not just random users, but these are, you're describing people who tend to be writing, expressing opinions, just, out there in a fairly normal way on the web. But, you know, people writing to you, Amanda, I'll rape you. How does that feel? People writing to others that they'll slit their throat and on and on and on. I can't even address overwhelmingly most of this on the air. It's just way too obscene, vulgar, explicit. And I would think cumulatively, no matter what you think of it, kind of terrifying.
Yeah, and it's also confusing because it is so readily dismissed by other people. So in my experience and in speaking with women who've also gone through this stuff, you know, there's so much pressure on us to be cool about it, but also to sort of monitor it in case it escalates. And that ends up taking a lot of, you know, emotional bandwidth. It takes up a lot of time, in some cases money, using programs to scrub the internet of your private information. In my case, I took a bunch of time out of work to get a protection order against an internet harasser in 2009. And so it really does end up impacting women's economic opportunities. And many women just, you know, retreat from the internet instead of having to deal with it.
Speak to the volume of this kind of abuse. Is this just a very tiny fringe way out on the edge in the really dark corners? You're suggesting it's not.
So your reaction when you read my story that it was very surprising to you is one that I've heard from many men, but I've heard from many women that it's totally unsurprising and it's something that they just deal with on a daily basis. And some of the women I talk about in the story are like me, you know, in a public role in some way. But I also found that women are more likely to be harassed just by using a dating site or entering a chat room, just very low-level sort of engagements with internet culture. And so I don't think we can sort of overestimate the problem.
You look at this research out of the University of Maryland, where just having an online account with a female name made a big difference. They set up a bunch of fake online accounts. They dispatched them into chat rooms. And what you write that accounts with feminine usernames incurred an average of 100 sexually explicit or threatening messages a day. Masculine names received 3.7. If that research is correct, then it's not surprising that a male like myself just might not see this in everyday life on the web.
Right. And it also just, you know, goes to show that it's not something that women are bringing upon themselves, that even, you know, silent robots are harassed. So it's a compelling figure.
We've got a little tape here. There's an instance of this in the UK that got very public in July. This was Stella Creasy, a Labour member of Parliament in the UK, revealed to the BBC that she had received threats of rape after she publicly supported campaigner Caroline Criado Perez, who was targeted by Twitter trolls after she had organized a campaign to put more women on British currency. Here's Stella Creasy talking about that.
And I think we need to differentiate between what are criminal matters, as in direct threats to rape me, which I have had people saying they're going to come round to my house at 8 or 9 o'clock this evening and film this taking place, and sexual violence, sexual harassment, sexual abusive messages that I've also received. This isn't about Twitter. This is about hatred of women and hatred of women who speak up. And indeed, some of those people sending the messages have been absolutely explicit about that. And actually, it's important that we don't think that somehow because this is happening online, it's any less violent, any less dangerous.
Amanda Hess writes about it in her essay, Why Women Aren't Welcome on the Internet. She's seen plenty and reported on plenty more. Obscene, violent, threatening, physically threatening, threats of murder and rape against women, just expressing opinions on the web. Amanda, how have you come to imagine who these people are putting up this kind of hateful, violent language?
That's a great question, and it's something that we don't have a lot of research on, but we have been able to see in a few cases where people have been prosecuted for these crimes who they are. And Caroline Criado Perez recently, the woman who had been campaigning for female faces on banknotes, she had two of her abusers plead guilty in the UK to charges related to threatening her online. And it was interesting. One of them seemed like sort of a typical basement troll type of guy, someone who hangs out on the internet and just sort of, you know, threatens women maybe for fun. And the other person who pled guilty was a woman who said that she was just sort of caught up in this, you know, fervor of threatening to rape another woman. And so she just sort of joined a mob of people who were doing that behavior. So I think it's sort of coming from a variety of places. But I agree that in general, the place that it's coming from, the rhetoric, is very similar to the types of harassment that we've seen facing women offline, whether it's sexual harassment in the workplace or harassment on the street. And so there's just a sort of generalized misogyny that still sort of creeps into our culture that's now bubbling up online.
Seems to me, in its explicitness, in its ferocity, a long step beyond what you're likely to hear on the street. I mean, rape threats, murder threats, beheading threats on the street or in an office, much more difficult, I would think, than online.
Yeah, you know, I think sexism takes different forms. And so on the street, it's just this sort of, you know, acknowledgement of a man when he's catcalling a woman that he has some sort of sexual power over her. And the idea that he's right there, it can be a bit frightening. Online, you know, because it's so anonymous and removed, I think people are a little bit less shy about being very vulgar. And also, I think some people, some trolls, feel like they can ramp up their rhetoric in order to really make it hit.
And they do. Amanda Hess, please stand by. We're talking about the ugly reservoir of internet aggression toward women. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the ugly reservoir of internet aggression toward women and the cost to women when they speak up, stand out online. Amanda Hess is my guest today, joining us from Pasadena, California. Writer all over the place, Slate, Wired, Los Angeles Times, ESPN, The Magazine, and more. Big piece in Pacific Standard Magazine that has turned a lot of heads, Why Women Aren't Welcome on the Internet. And that puts a very mild face on the hideous threats and reactions that she and many others report getting when they simply put opinions up online, simply have a presence as a woman online. You can join us this hour. Women, have you been hit by this, the violent sexual language that can come at women online? Were you surprised? Were you shocked? Have you come to expect it? What was the setting? What seemed to bring it on? And what's the right response when you get hit with this kind of attack online? Retweet, delete, block? Call the police? We'll hear from a moment from the founding editor of Jezebel.com, Anna Holmes, and professor of law, Danielle Citron will join us. Here's a little bit from, this is back in 2011. There was a very popular Reddit moderator, Violent Acres, very, very tough stuff. His identity was exposed as Michael Brooch. Gawker called Violent Acres the biggest troll on the web, creating Reddit boards called Creep Shots, Jailbait, Rape Bait, Incest. In 2012, he spoke here to CNN's Drew Griffin about the thrill.
When all of this was at its height, the audience was appreciative and supportive of the sort of gallows humor that I put out there.
Did you get a thrill out of that?
Honestly, the biggest thrill I got was those meaningless internet points.
Kind of internet standing, but gallows humor, to say the least. It was ugly. He said in that interview that he ended up feeling some regret.
I have, as with the rape and pregnant Reddits, I have come around over the last few months to understand that some of these things can be harmful to other people.
But under the cover of anonymity, people will write just incredible things. Here's BBC radio broadcaster Richard Bacon. He looked into that whole culture in a documentary called The Antisocial Network and talked to one of the UK's leading experts in online harassment and bullying. This is psychologist Dr. Emma Short. He asked her about what motivates those really rough internet trolls.
Some people are doing it to intimidate, to frighten, to control, and other people are doing it purely for notoriety and to get their own following. If you are someone who lives your life largely online, I think that margin begins to blur, and actually it's just cyberspace. It's a behaviour I'm engaging in, I like doing it, I'll send another message. And the impact you're having, I think, almost becomes irrelevant because the reward is the behaviour itself. It feels good, you get nastier and nastier.
Nastier and nastier, says Dr. Emma Short. Amanda Hess, it's just cyberspace. But there are real-world implications here. What's the net effect, do you think, for individual women and women as a whole in a time when so much of life has migrated to the web?
Well, as I wrote in my piece, one of the common dismissals of police officers and others to women who are dealing with abuse on the internet is, you know, just close your laptop or just quit Twitter. We don't understand why you're on it anyway.
Yeah.
But that's something that I am required to use for my job. And so that's not a possibility for me. And I think what we've seen is it's very easy for the harassers to not see this as a real world incident. It's easy for police to dismiss it because then they don't have to investigate it. But, it's not possible for women to dismiss it, A, because it's coming straight into our homes, into basically our virtual workplaces. And also because, you know, if we were to close our computers, we're still at heightened risk for sexual violence, for sexual harassment. And so it's not something for us that purely lives on the internet.
Anna Holmes joins us in a moment. Let's go to a couple of callers first. New Orleans, Louisiana. Chris is calling. Chris, you're on the air.
Yeah, in response to some of the things that your speaker is saying, I work for a local law enforcement agency in the New Orleans region, mm-hmm. and I will say over the last 5 years, we've gotten the tools and the equipment and the knowledge to start tracking down a lot of these people. When a victim comes to us with threats of or harassment, bodily harm, we take these matters seriously, and we work with the victims and a lot of these social networking platforms such as Twitter, Facebook, a lot of email providers to track these people down and to bring them to justice so that these victims are not continuously victimized over and over and over.
Chris, how do you do that? You're in the New Orleans area. The person posting a tweet could be in Nova Scotia, for all we know, or, you know, the in Maine. How do you physically track them down and stop it?
We work with social networking companies to identify these users via IP address and other computer addresses. Then we contact those internet service providers with a valid court order, and we work with those law enforcement agencies in a jurisdiction of where this person may reside. So we actually build a connection from our law enforcement agency to their law enforcement agency. We work one-on-one with an investigator where that person may reside to track this person down and then to bring charges against them.
Amanda, do you think that's what it's going to take? And do you see what Chris is describing out of New Orleans as common nationally?
First of all, thank you so much, Chris. That is wonderful. It's certainly not totally representative. It's not the experience that I had in Palm Springs or in Washington, D.C. It's certainly not the experience that many women I've spoken to have had. But I have seen some indication that police officers have read my story and have taken it well. And I'm sure, jurisdictions across the United States are very different.
No question about that. Amanda Hess, please stand by in Pasadena. I want to invite Anna Holmes into the conversation, founding editor of Jezebel.com, the online women's news and culture blog, author of the Book of Jezebel, columnist at the New York Times Book Review. She was with us not so long ago right here. Anna Holmes, welcome back to On Point. I'm sorry to be talking about this in a way, but here it is. What do you think of what's described in Amanda's big essay, Anna?
Well, I've long been a fan of Amanda, so I wasn't surprised that she so kind of deftly and
nailed
powerfully,
it mm-hmm.
and yeah, totally nailed it. It's interesting because my experience as an editor, which is really when I started quote unquote working online, kept me somewhat distant from direct threats made against me. I think that there were threats made against my writers, mm-hmm. Some of which they shared with me, some of which they didn't. But as an editor or as the former editor of Jezebel, when I was running Jezebel, I wasn't the target of a lot of threats and abuse, but I was aware that it was going on. I do think it also there's a difference between, let's say, being on Twitter and broadcasting your thoughts to anyone who wants to follow you to the world at large, and writing for a very female audience that, to me, it feels like a women's website, for example, is somewhat more protective in that, you know, when we had trolls come in or people throwing abuse at us, they just got they got, you know, their comments would either be deleted or they or
mobbed by other readers, perhaps.
Sure, sure. So, so there was kind of self-policing, but it's a bit more Wild West-like when you talk about websites that don't have moderated comment sections. When you look at Twitter, for example, where I think a lot of this is going on, I can't really speak to Facebook because I don't use Facebook that much, and it does feel like there is a bit more control there. But you know, again, this is a reflection of the ways that women are looked at and have been looked at for decades, if not centuries.
And I was stunned by the explicit, gruesome ferocity of a lot of what Amanda reported here. Were you? Mm-hmm.
Was I stunned by it? I was very disturbed by it and upset by it, but I was not surprised. So no, I was not stunned by it because I've certainly heard this stuff before. It's not been directed at me, but I have been aware that this sort of vitriol is being hurled at women and has been for a long time on the internet. And I think that some people have a really hard time with women who speak their mind or who speak at all.
John in Newton, Massachusetts. John, thank you for calling. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. I find this conversation very interesting. I ran an anti-SUV campaign, a sport utility vehicle campaign, as early as 2003. And we ticketed, I don't know, maybe a million SUVs. And
ticketed, meaning you put something under their windshield wiper that said, don't drive this big thing or something?
Exactly.
Okay.
And I got hundreds of death threats. I got emails saying that people would run me over, and they would be hosing me out of their wheel wells, and I had to unlist my phone numbers, and it was insane. I mean, on a daily basis, I got death threats.
So what are you saying, John? Get over it, women? Everybody gets fierce?
No. I was appalled, and I didn't feel that there was anything I could do. I think it's horrible. For some reason, you know, the internet brings out this kind of horrible side in people. I had a conversation with a woman who said, okay, so what should I drive if I don't drive an SUV? I said, well, get a minivan or something. And she said, well, if I'm in an accident, I'd rather you die than me. I said, well, what if you hit your mother? You know, and she's in the other car. And the woman started threatening me.
Okay. Well, I mean, there's relative risk of different cars, but 300 to 400 death threats just for talking about SUVs. And there's a guy. I mean, Amanda, what's your response? Here's a male who's just campaigning against SUVs. He's got, I don't know, hundreds of death threats. Does that mean that there's a parallel here between, you know, rough play, to say the very least, on the internet for men and women?
Well, it's clear that men receive threatening messages as well. What I found in researching my story is that, you know, there's a volume issue where women are more likely to receive it, first of all. Second, it seems to be, you know, when people threaten women, they tend to threaten them in a gendered way. So they're specifically calling out their gender, their body, their appearance, threatening to rape them, etc. And the last thing is, we are still living in a world where, you know, the worlds of online writing, of journalism, of technology, all places where women are receiving threats are still extremely male-dominated. And so there is a need to address this issue specifically among women. And I think, you know, as we've seen in many civil rights movements in the United States, that can only benefit everyone. So it will benefit women. It will benefit, you know, people like John. It will benefit everyone who sort of gets to enjoy the opinions of women.
It's just
Tom,
it's kind of too early to believe. Yeah, Anna, you're on.
Yeah, I just wanted to say something in reaction to what Amanda said and also what John said. It seems that when men are threatened or abused online, at least, it's because of something they said or something they did. A lot of times women are being abused or threatened just because of who they are. And I think that, you know, John's anecdote somewhat illustrates that, because he was having abuse hurled at him because of something he said online.
Yeah.
Whereas I do think that just the mere act of speaking or being female is what sets a lot of people off.
Terry in New York. Clarence, New York. Thanks for calling, Terry. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, one of the things somebody else mentioned, too, is about the fact that the internet sort of brings out the worst in people, and there's the anonymity and sort of the cowardliness that's allowed to come along with it. But I think we can all understand how that happens to people, because, for instance, if you're walking down a sidewalk and somebody walks in front of you, you know, and you bump, you just be like, oh my gosh, sorry, excuse me. But if that happens when you're behind the wheel of a car and somebody cuts in front of you, all of a sudden, you know, you feel like this greater degree of anger and you sort of turn into a different person. And I think maybe the internet is almost like that too.
Yeah, just let it fly because it's anonymous. Let me get one more right here. Terry, thank you for that. Jane in Melrose, Massachusetts. Jane, you're on.
Hi, Tom. My experience is from women. I've had a lot of ferocious and hateful women who tried to destroy my credibility online. When I first got online, I had a very nice-looking avatar, whole nice account. My blog was kicking. Everything was going well.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I was being called a nasty name by a woman that I've never met before.
But was it death threats? Was it death threats, rape threats, all that kind of stuff, Jane, or just...
No, it wasn't that, but it was a real nasty word that of course I can't say online.
Yeah.
But anyhow, yeah. When it's said in public, it can cost you dearly. It costs you, you know, followers, it costs you business, it can cost you quite a lot. I had to end up deleting that account,
yeah.
And now I had to bring back a new account using a fake avatar. I got rid of my old blog, and now I have a brand new blog.
Yeah.
It's just this sort of thing. So instead of me being not anonymous, I went from that to being anonymous.
Yeah.
You know, just to hold an account online.
And women hitting two there. Jen, I appreciate your call. I want to go to Baltimore, Maryland right now. Danielle Citron is with us, professor of law at the University of Maryland in Baltimore, author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, coming out very soon. Danielle Citron, thanks for joining us. What's the proper role of the law here? When this whole thing began, I think it was unimaginable that we'd have police patrolling the internet for harassers, but maybe that's where we've come. What do you think, Danielle?
No, there's absolutely a role for the law. The kind of experience, you know, that Amanda tells us about and so many victims have talked to me about involve activity that law prohibits. True threats, cyber harassment, cyber stalking are covered by criminal penalties at the state and federal level. So the kind of persistent harassment that these folks experience and graphic threats of violence are something that society has already made a determination isn't acceptable. So we have laws on the books. They may be imperfect, but they can cover this kind of activity. And as Amanda's piece has brought alive, police officers often, unlike Chris, you know, say to folks, turn off your computer, it's no big deal, boys mm-hmm. will be boys,
mm-hmm.
Or they just are ill. They just don't have the education in the law that exists.
Professor Citron, what do you say to people who say, come on, you know, it's just the web, it's just theater. It may be rough, it may be even obscene, but it's theater because it's the internet.
Ah, I wish I could say that. You know, network technologies are crucial to our careers, employment opportunities, people's social media scores have everything to do with the possibility of getting a job. And when people go offline, they lose opportunities to, you know, attract employers. When employers see that there, you know, are harassment threats or suggestions that they're interested in anonymous sex or lies about them, reputation-harming lies, they just don't get interviewed and hired. And let alone the possibility that when online posts suggest that you're interested in rape or you're interested in anonymous sex, of course untrue, that people aren't going to show up at your door, and they do. And there have been cases of actual rape due to when someone's impersonated online. Individuals believe that they're interested in sex, and they're confronted and raped. So there's a real possibility of physical violence, let alone becoming unemployable.
We've got 20 seconds before the break. Is the law enforcement approach to this evolving, changing, Professor Citron?
I think, you know, as Chris suggests, there is some movement, you know, thanks to media coverage, Tom, that you've been doing for a number of years and speaking out. It's not that there's no movement. In the last 5 years, there have been 8 federal cyber stalking prosecutions, but that's 8. It's a small amount. So I think there is some improvement at the state and federal level. We can do better.
Julia in Bluffton, South Carolina. Julia, you're on the air.
I just wanted to say this, that this is a vehicle that is in plain sight that is being facilitated by the bullies, the perpetrators, to hurl their verbal bullets of threat, rape, and demise at all those people that are innocent to and vulnerable to their actions. And the validation that they need is in plain sight as well.
What's the validation of threatening rape and murder? What's the validation in that, Julia?
Well, if you're listening to a woman tell you she's being threatened, it seems the burden of proof has always been on her, or always been on the victim and not the perpetrator.
And here online, thrown anonymously and thrown aplenty from these reports. Julia, thanks for that. Terry in Brewstertown, Tennessee. Terry, you're on.
Hello, Tom. Thanks both for the subject and letting me on. These crimes are crimes and should be treated as crimes. If they're not treated as crimes by law enforcement, that is a crime.
Terry, we heard
conveying a threat of any kind is a crime.
Terry, I appreciate your call. We heard a policeman in the New Orleans area saying they're taking it that way. Danielle Citron in Baltimore, Amanda Hess says her experience around the country suggests that many police departments are not, maybe don't even know how, cannot. You know, the policeman who came to her door in Palm Springs, his question was, what is Twitter? If that's where you're starting, and I don't mean that mockingly, not everybody's on it, why should they be? But if that's where a policeman's starting, it's a long way to real deterrence, isn't it, Danielle?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so many police officers, just like so many of us, are ignorant about network technologies. They don't even know where to begin to figure out, you know, where perpetrators are and really to understand its seriousness. And so it's not unusual for especially rural and local law enforcement to just say they have no idea. They're just totally outpaced by the technology and just don't know how to handle it.
Anna Holmes, if this goes on in the way that Amanda describes, what break does this put on women's lives, careers, just free expression in our society?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think that women from a very young age are socialized, at least historically, to not speak up in the same ways that boys are encouraged to do so. And with the internet, you have this really vibrant, amazing platform in which you can speak your mind, especially for people who have been historically marginalized. And by that, I mean not just women, but people of color and LGBT people. When you have this sort of pushback, and I would describe it as pushback in a way, against historically marginalized communities who are speaking out, yes, it does give some people pause, and they will pull punches, or they will go away, or they will decide that it isn't worth it. And I think that, you know, what we're missing then, what we're all missing out on, is a variety and a vibrancy of voices.
Amanda, how have you come to think about the psychosocial reasons that this kind of really ugly stuff is out there? Or do you care? I mean, are you looking to analyze why would somebody do this, or do you just want it stopped, or both?
I, you know, as a journalist, I'm fascinated by it. And as someone who has been threatened, you know, part of the reason that I reported the threats to the police was because I wanted to know who was threatening me. It was a very sort of basic right that I wanted to cash in on that I couldn't access. But, you know, the thing that I take away from it is, you know, unlike one caller who said that the internet really facilitates us to be our worst version of ourselves, I think, you know, I've created such a wonderful community of friends and colleagues on the internet, and I think we're all trying to be our best person. And, you know, that's maybe a shift in the way that we're seeing the internet from this sort of dark corner of society to really, you know, society itself. And I'm hopeful that as that continues to happen, we can all sort of better recognize who's still, like, lurking in these corners and how we're going to sort of deal with them as a virtual society.
Brian in New Philadelphia, Ohio. Brian, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, I just wanted to say, I think some websites are actually starting to take steps to make people actually own their comments. A lot of it, I think, has to do with the fact that people online can stay anonymous and they don't have to own up to what they say. But I know, I think Google, YouTube, I want to say Popular Science, have taken the route of not allowing anonymous made-up usernames. You actually have to use your name and own your comments.
Brian, I appreciate your call. Danielle Citron, what about the, is traditional the right word here, anonymity of the internet? Does it look like that will always be the case, or do you see more people required to be there by name in your real identity so that if you've got threats to make, you've got responsibility as well?
You know, you're seeing that sites like Facebook insisting that their groups can't be anonymous. So it's true that Facebook users have to write in their own names, or if they don't, they can be removed. Their groups often have pseudonymous sponsors, and so there's been a change in policy in Facebook that if you write abusive commentary, especially towards women, they will insist that they claim and write under their own names, or they're going to take down those groups. And that's true of a number of sites, like sort of insisting that we have real identified, you know, real identities on these sites. And the question is, what do we sacrifice, of course, when we have real identities online? We might sacrifice a lot. And I'm not entirely convinced that real identities, at least as told to the public, you know, publicly, is going to cure the problem.
Amanda Hess, we've just got a minute here, but what have you come to conclude, that this will sort of be self-cleansing as the Internet becomes more normalized part of society, and this will be seen as just too offensive and grotesque to be out there, or that this is perpetual if we don't somehow change the structure of Internet function?
You know, I see it similarly to violence and harassment against women offline, where now we have legal frameworks for addressing domestic violence against women, sexual harassment in the workplace. It's not that those things don't happen anymore, of course. There's still problems. But we've sort of, as a society, been able to agree that they are unacceptable. And I'm hoping that we're going to take the same tack with harassment of women on the Internet.
Mm. You have raised our antenna way high as to the cost of it, the ugliness of it, the pervasiveness of it for women who are out there with opinions. And for that, we thank you. Amanda Hess, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Amanda Hess, her essay in Pacific Standard Magazine is Why Women Aren't Welcome on the Internet. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Anna Holmes, it's always great to have you and your perspective on the world. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Danielle Citron, professor of law at the University of Maryland, Baltimore. Look for her forthcoming book, Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. Professor Citron, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rob.
In a moment, tweeting about terminal illness. Is this one step too far for social media, or do we all have a right to share our life experiences, however personal? This is On Point. Coping with a terminal illness is a personal affair, but what happens when someone chooses to make it public? Lisa Adams has stage 4 breast cancer. She regularly tweets intimate details of her condition and the treatment she's receiving. She was recently the subject of columns written by Emma G. Keller in The Guardian, and 4 days later by Emma Keller's husband, Bill Keller, in The New York Times. They raised questions about her chronicling her breast cancer treatment on the Internet. Their comments, judgments, have drawn controversy. Joining me now from New York is Lisa Belkin, senior columnist at The Huffington Post, who recently wrote about the episode. Lisa Belkin, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Good to be here, Tom.
Who's Lisa Adams? And give us a sense of what she's been tweeting about her cancer.
Lisa Adams is a mother of three. When she was 37 years old, 7 years ago, she was diagnosed first with breast cancer, which she beat back. And then about 2 years ago, found that it had metastasized. And about 2 months ago, things started to go badly. And she's been in the hospital, as she puts it, I've been in the hospital since 2013. And she's now having radiation for metastases to her bones. And she has been writing for much of this time very openly about what it means to live with this disease. And it's a raw blog with now about 9,000 followers, and it's very, very personal.
And not writing a little, but writing a lot. Lots and lots
writing
of tweets.
Writing a lot. So, and that was what Emma pointed out. As of yesterday, Lisa had 166,000 tweets, which is phenomenal by any measure, because she chronicles her thoughts as she thinks them. And this is a running look at her life.
So Emma Keller and then Bill Keller came in with two different perspectives on this. I mean, people tweet about all kinds of things, and they tweet about personal things. I mean, for heaven's sakes, NPR's Scott Simon tweeted about his mother's death as she was dying. What did Emma Keller and Bill Keller have to say in their columns about Lisa Adams tweeting?
Well, they raised two different sets of questions. Emma's piece was very much about, is this a new way of death? Is this a new way of living with terminal illness? I think she says, or have we replaced deathbed selfies with funeral selfies? And it's an observation worth making, but I think in her case, as in Bill's case, Bill was not talking about the publicity about this. Bill was talking actually about the fight. He then went on to compare...
The fight against cancer.
The fight against cancer. Mm-hmm. He went on to sort of compare Lisa's battle with his own father-in-law's death. And his father-in-law's death was peaceful, was just a morphine drip. He, you know, and then Bill went on to explore why are we using battle terminology in terms of cancer, and what does this do to those who decide that it is not the fight, worth the fight. So Emma's talking about technology and media, you know, spreading the word and too much information. And Bill is talking about technology and just doing too much treatment. And they both used Lisa Adams as an example. And they raised really good questions with what turns out to be a very imperfect example.
Imperfect, why? Because Lisa Adams, for all her tweeting, is in some sense not a public figure, and so their great big footprint was too big for her example?
There was a lot going on, and the wrong example for different reasons. So Emma's piece, I found, I had more problems with.
The headline was, "Forget funeral selfies, what are the ethics of tweeting a terminal illness?"
Terminal illness.
Suggesting that there's some ethical problem with tweeting about your terminal cancer.
And the suggestion that she was telling us too much, and the answer to that from everyone was, so don't read it. Emma herself is a cancer survivor. Emma had a double mastectomy a year ago. She understands this. I don't think either of the Kellers woke up in the morning and decided, let's beat up on Lisa Adams. I think they were both taken by her story and doing what they do. As journalists, they were saying, you know, this speaks to me because here is an issue that I want to explore further. There just wasn't a match between Lisa's larger story and the subject they wanted to explore further.
But there was judgment here. She wrote, would we, the readers, be more dignified if we turned away, suggesting that there was something undignified going on in this tweeting. The Guardian has now taken her column down. Why? What was the offense that led to that?
Well, the specific reason given was because Emma and Lisa had direct message conversations and private email conversations, and Emma then quoted those. And the feeling was that this was not a public figure, and she shouldn't have been quoting her private correspondence without telling her she was writing this.
She later said she regretted that, but the column is down. Meanwhile,
the column is down.
Mm-hmm, and Bill Keller's column, Heroic Measures, is the headline. This was, in some ways, deeper, kind of suggesting that Lisa Adams shouldn't even be fighting so hard.
Right, and there is a very important conversation to be had about end-of-life care and the amount of both money but also just emotional anguish that we spend fighting a battle that is already lost. But that's not what Lisa Adams happens to be doing. She has stage 4 breast cancer. It has metastasized. It is going to be a tough fight, and I'm very aware of the number of times I use words like fight and battle now that those have become, you know, something that we're arguing over. It's going to be a tough road. But I, in my original lead on my piece, said that the internet is painting this, you know, very too simplistically as the bullying Kellers versus a dying woman. And there was an immediate outcry from cancer patients saying she's not dying until she and her doctor say she's dying. And they were right. The reality of cancer nowadays is you can live for decades beating it back. Something can be terminal even. Something can be incurable. But you are not at this moment dying. And Lisa Adams is not dying. She does. She is living. From certainly, that is her worldview.
Lisa, what, so we just got a few.
You know, use this as well. Mm-hmm. You why are you fighting so hard? Go mm-hmm. ahead and die quietly. Was the way it was being read.
What's fair here when anyone can become a public figure? We've just got 20 seconds, but Lisa Adams has made herself a public figure. Then it blew up bigger, I imagine, than she ever expected. What's fair commentary once someone's on Twitter telling such intimacy?
I think both husband and wife do not write about the same thing in such public forums when they are such public figures. That's part of what made this feel unfair. And I think that you'd better be pretty certain that the example you're using is actually an example of the point you're trying to make.
Lisa Belkin, senior columnist with the Huffington Post, writes on life and work and family. Lisa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.